This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show, if you can believe it. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
I can tell that it sometimes looks like we are fooling around and there is a lot of mishaps or things that doesn't sort of succeed, but we take ourselves the liberty, or the team and myself, we enjoy the foolishness of also just seeing what comes out of things that are unpredictable.
What can designers learn from artists, and where does one discipline end and the other begin? We sit down with Icelandic Danish artist Olafur Eliasson to find out a little more. Plus,
we'll make the strap asymmetrical. One way it'll bend really nicely, another way it'll bend in a much bigger bend, which is much better when you put it on your wrist.
How do you refine the design of a watch strap? Well, London-based Uniform Wears talks about tightening up practices while keeping business ticking over nicely. Monocle's fashion editor also pops up with a report on a must-watch menswear brand. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Whether it's moving 40 tons of Icelandic rock to a museum to recreate a riverbed, or orchestrating the illusion of a sunrise indoors, or for that matter, dyeing a river completely green, artist Olafur Eliasson and his Berlin-based team experiment with space and light to create enigmatic interventions to dazzle and delight the onlooker. Earlier this year, Eliasson also completed his very first building, a castle-like office space that's literally lapped by the waters of a Danish fjord, and he's created a team that will focus on architectural projects. To chronicle his work to date, he's also released a new book entitled Olafur Eliasson Experience, which is published by Fyden. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis, this show's producer, met with the artist recently here in London to find out a little more.
I'm based in Berlin. I'm originally from Denmark and Iceland. I grew up in Denmark, really, born by Icelandic parents. And I've been in Berlin, I think, now for 25 years.
And I just wanted to cast my mind back to the first time that I saw one of your projects in person. It was at the Louisiana Museum, the beautiful museum in Denmark, and it was the riverbed project. And I just remember walking through the corridors, through the museum, you know, paintings, Giacometti sculptures, and suddenly come into this room and see this riverbed and being very, very surprised, especially to see it in a gallery, really. It was just so unexpected, but so beautiful. How important is the unexpected, I guess, in your work and surprising your audience?
The whole riverbed being, I think it was like 40 or 50 tons of rocks from Iceland, where we took a riverbed quite literally, put it into containers and then shipped it to Denmark and then installed it in I think 4 or 5 galleries at the Louisiana Museum. There is sort of a surprise, you could say, between what we see and then what we feel. You could say that we are so used to the kind of ocular, the cognitive relationship to the world. I mean, we read magazines, we look at a lot of, we see a lot. I mean, we know a lot, but physically speaking, we are a little less informed. We don't experience everything. Obviously, you can't experience everything that you learn or you read about. So I'm quite interested in the kind of discrepancy in first seeing something like the riverbed and then actually moving through it physically, because of course the stones are crunchy, they move under your feet, it's a little bit destabilizing, they were slanted, but you're sort of walking up a river, right? So there was a lot of kind of sensorial elements in this that had a lot to do with, how should I say, the sort of embodied experience. And at some point the eyes just is a little less important. And this, I think, is a nice surprise, that you can see with your body.
I get the sense that you're looking for something. I mean, experimentation is a big part of your work, whether it's with colour or light or even illusions. To what extent do you have a specific brief that you give your team to work on? To what extent is it quite open?
Oh, well, when I work in my studio, we sort of start an analytical process, some of which is very theoretically sort of driven, or, you know, kind of more science, classic academia, reading who wrote something about this, who's been involved with, you know, movement or temporal sort of activity, what is the sequence instead of a thing? Can we propose the idea that an object is really not an object, it's a journey, right? It's moving from here to there, even though it's maybe just a cup, but the cup came from somewhere, it's going somewhere, it has an agency, it's, you know, has a lot of built-in information. We also celebrate playfulness and experimentation and you could call sort of non-quantifiable success criteria. And I wouldn't call it fooling around, but I mean, I can tell that it sometimes looks like we are fooling around and there is a lot of mishaps or things that doesn't sort of succeed. But we take ourselves the liberty, or the team and myself, we enjoy the foolishness of also just seeing what comes out of things that are unpredictable.
Tell me a bit about your team. I think you have people from very different backgrounds, and tell me how you work together. You've written a book called The Kitchen about the importance of communal eating and how important it is to cooking and eating and sharing food together in part of your daily routine, and how important it is to your creative process.
Within the Artist Studio, there's a various smaller teams. There's a great team of craftsmen, and there's a team of researchers, sort of people who are involved with also communication and text and social media and computer and film and so on. And then there's an amazing team of architects. And some of the teams has been broken into an actual architectural office. So now I have an architectural office together with my long-term studio manager, Sebastian Behmann, called SOS, Studio Other Spaces. And with another group, which is slightly disconnected from the studio, I'm involved with a small solar lantern project called Little Sun, which is about energy, access to energy, and especially in areas where there's no access to energy. So the studio sort of, I mean, the whole group is about 120, maybe 30 people. And at the center of this, there's a kitchen where we take the sort of social space of eating and dining and sort of having lunch together very serious. And we also try to take the sort of scientific or artistic approach into the kitchen, so that we not only enjoy the food, but we also explore where did that food come from, what's the consequences also in terms of sustainability or ecology of eating this, and how do we sort of handle this. And in that sense, the studio has become, I mean, I hope it's a place where when I come to the studio, I see the world in greater definition. So it's not a sort of escapistic space where I leave the world behind, or I sort of walk into the studio to kind of go away from reality. It's a kind of a place where reality is more dense, and I'm in greater contact with it.
Obviously, you're an artist, but I think it's fair to say that you're a designer in some ways as well. How important is the design process in your work?
What I do, I consider art. Also, when I design things, I was lucky to just do some furnitures in collaboration with Moroso, the Italian design company, which is, I think, an amazing company. So I'm very proud about that. I work with Quadrat, which is a textile firm. I love Quadrat, so I'm super proud about that. But the way I approach these things are the same way as I approach art. I think that the cultural sector, not just art, but the cultural sector has a kind of qualitative ambition, which is just a little bit different than design. And of course, I love design, but I mean, frankly speaking, design is also to a large extent very market driven. And the role of the client or the market has, I think, to some extent also maybe colonized the kind of criticality one would expect from design. So now you have sort of critical pockets in design. And I do think that the artistic, what should I say, more explorative or more political, or the kind of agendas that art might be, maybe can sort of apply within a design structure, within a design process, are of great value. And I actually don't necessarily think that I'm a great designer. I'm not sure that if I say that I'm a designer, then I probably make my first mistake.
Having said that, you've for some years collaborated on various buildings, and this year you actually designed your own building, your first one in Denmark.
Fjordhus in Danish, it just means the house in the fjord, because it's quite literally standing in the water. Yeah, so I was lucky to have an amazing client who has a foundation that looks after the client's money, and the client was interested in making a house that is both a work of art, a sculpture you could say, and a functioning house. And I worked on it with the team in the studio for 9 years. It was a very unique experience, and we were lucky to get to design every single step, every single process, and so on and so forth. The first floor is just a work of art. And in that sense, it's a really fantastic building for me to have made, and obviously a kind of opportunity where a lot of the artistic work that I've done for the last 25 years comes together.
Are you working on any other architectural projects at the moment or in future?
Well, with its studio team and the architectural office, SOS, we are working on a very large architectural project in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, which is both a park and sort of a kind of a foundation. It's called the Meles Foundation, a memorial foundation for the late President Meles. And we're working with a great network of collaborators, both craftsmen and technicians and local architects and so on. So it's a quite complex project. The landscaping has been done with Günter Vogt out of Switzerland. Very exciting. And we have a whole sort of ambition of trying to explore indigenous species, both in plant life and animal life. And so it's a very ambitious and also a kind of a long-term project. Besides that, I've been involved for a while already with what we could call smaller architectural commissions, with, you know, adding to a house or building a roof. And, you know, the kind of more usual things that is very exciting, because you can do sort of experiments simply on a door, on a window, on a roof, and these sort of smaller projects. These type of projects I do all the time.
Your work has gone to the stage where it appeals to what you call the non-professional artistic community as well, so a wider audience, it's fair to say. Is that something that makes you happy, and what do you attribute that to? Is it something that you tried for?
Well, I've always been interested in embracing the diversity of people who comes to an exhibition. And I have also always raised the fact that even though the museums think of themselves as being highly democratic, there's a lot of people who do not either go or feel welcome at institutions. And I've been very interested in how do we, in a more active way, reach out to these people and also host them so that we acknowledge the fact that, well, some people they feel insecure and they don't feel welcome and they don't understand, why do I have to look at this? It doesn't make any sense. And how do we make sure that these people are being told, well, this is okay. You are perfectly correct to say this does not make any sense in the normal way of understanding what makes sense. So in that sense, I think that there is a lot of work to be done still within how does art simply reach out into the communities, and how does the community also feel about the cultural institutions. This sort of elitism that still kind of hovers in art, and obviously a lot of that comes out of the so-called art market. And a lot of people simply make the mistake to think that the art market and the art world is the same. But it's not. The art market is a trading platform, and the art world is the cultural sector in our greater communities and society. It's about civic society. The art market is not about civic society. It's about profitability, and, you know, also they're great collectors. So I see that it's a little more complex than I'm saying it here. But by all means, if art was not about society, why would we make it then?
Our very special thanks to the artist Olafur Eliasson, who was speaking there, to Monocle's very own Daphne Karnesis. Olafur Eliasson, Experience, is out now and available at all self-respecting bookshops. It's published by Fiden. For want of a better phrase, watchmaking is a time-honoured tradition. History and legacy are both important qualities, as is the highest mark of manufacturing when it comes to making the things. But what can young brands offer in a marketplace filled with old-timers? London-based Uniform Wears decided early that change in innovation would be its focus. For the past few years, it's been developing a new watch strap, the first of its kind, with a tech firm named BetaType. We sent this show's editor, the ever-patient Christy Evans, to Uniform Wear's workshop to see these straps for herself and find out if technology and tradition can tick along at the same tempo.
As I make my way to meet the subjects of this piece on a cold and wet Thursday afternoon, irony strikes. I am running late, and so are my hosts. When I finally arrive at BetaType's office in East London, I'm greeted by founder Sarat and Matthew, the company's principal designer, as well as Uniform Wear's creative director, Michael Carr. Each of them, I notice, are sporting watches with the newly launched T5 titanium mesh NATO strap. I'm keen to have a closer look, but we have plenty of time, and so we chat for a while about Uniform Wear's unique position within the industry. Michael is quick to point out that although innovation is at the heart of what they do, they still think tradition is a key element.
We still work with traditional manufacturers. We have some straps that are made one by one by hand with a company in Paris. Some of the finishing that goes on is done by hand, and you can't really achieve it any other way. That's good. But where we can innovate, we will. And that will be in, at the moment, the strap was a good test bed for that. But we're looking forward to taking that forward into other parts, cases, dials and utilising that wherever we can. As a brand, we don't look at it as like an and-or situation where it's like either we innovate or we stay traditional. We don't look at it like that at all.
Collaborating with like-minded brands is also a major part of the company's ethos. So they didn't need much persuading when they received an email from Betatype, a company that specialises in additive manufacturing. That's 3D printing to you and me. With most of their contracts residing in industries such as F1, aerospace and medicine, it seemed odd that they had approached uniform wears for a foray into consumer manufacturing. But for Sarah, it was an obvious choice.
Where we come from as individuals and a lot of people in the studio is actually from a design background or are heavily influenced by design. And actually, that kind of element of that is always something that we're looking towards. I remember quite distinctly seeing a uniform wears watch in a store in Soho and kind of going, I can look at that watch and from that I can kind of read into the philosophy of what these guys are about. And actually, I think this is something that's worthwhile. So yeah, we took a punt.
Knowing that not just one, but several designers have been working meticulously on the wrist strap, I can wait no longer and ask to take a look. My initial reaction is one of complete and utter surprise. It's titanium, but feels just like a woven fabric. The coolness and weight associated with metal are absent. It is handsome, sleek, and feels completely effortless to wear. But Matthew explains to me that the design process was anything but.
With the process, you need to have powder around each link when you build it to allow those links to move when the powder is removed. So it always has to be a small space between the links. So initially we started with quite large spaces between those links to make sure we had the movement. But then we ended up with quite a chunky mesh, which you can see here, there's quite a lot of movement within it. And also within the design process, we need to think about how the strap would actually connect with the watch as well. With the NATO design, we need the strap to be able to fit between the watch case and the spring bar. So we need to get a minimum thickness to that strap. So one of the big areas was to be able to design links that were small enough to move and be able to fit through the watch. And we got down to, it's like 1.54 millimeters thick strap, but still be able to bend in both directions and have the kind of characteristics of this free movement that's soft and gentle rather than kind of this bunching design, as you can see in the early prototypes, where it kind of ends up as just kind of like this mess.
We're actually modelling every single element of this strap. We can individually move every single element of the link by microns, essentially. Things that you wouldn't even really be able to physically see. We were just shifting and modifying and like actually adapting every single link in a level of detail that actually you wouldn't really associate with industrial design. You'd associate it with material engineering. Also, you know, a lot of the complexity that's within this object in terms of its behavior is all kind of built upon this new capability that comes from additive manufacturing. And I think this is where it becomes so exciting from a design side.
We were looking at the challenge of folding the strap back on itself so you could clip the clip on there.
Yeah.
And so we were really focused on getting this really, really tight bend radius so that the watch would bend really nicely over itself. But we had that on both sides of the watch, the strap, do you remember?
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, we'll make the strap asymmetrical. One way it'll bend really nicely, and the other way it'll bend in a much bigger bend, which is much better when you put it on your wrist.
I mean, the second major one was the clasp, because whether you have whatever traditional strap you have, whether it be a Milanese mesh or leather strap or a metal bracelet, you've got to separately fix, you've got a set of separate components which make up a clasp which fits it on your wrist. We didn't have that restriction in that we didn't have to have separate components. We could include it. It could be made in this one process.
The clasp in question is a brand new directional design. Microscopic teeth are integrated into the inside, which interlock with the weave of the strap itself. The guys assure me it's so functional, it can be done single-handed. As we head down to the printing room, the guys show me a sheet of 12 perfectly made straps, which the machine printed overnight. Having never seen something like this before, I'm surprised at how minimal the operation is. Inside a small room is a printer, around 6 foot high and 5 across. A small window reveals the action inside as a spark travels up and down the plate.
push a very thin layer of titanium powder across, and then the laser's coming down and fully melting that powder, essentially. So basically, something like this is actually made out of hundreds, potentially thousands of layers of individual melted kind of structure, and that powder is incredibly fine. So we're talking about 15 to 45 microns, but the process itself is actually, you know, there's a high recyclability, so obviously only the powder that we melt is actually being used, so we can build straps with just like 5 kilos of powder and just keep building them without ever really running out of that kind of material. And actually here, in terms of power usage, you know, we don't have much in terms of infrastructural or consumable use, so one like bottle of welding argon and we're pretty much good to go.
The benefits of the technology are game-changing, but sometimes big innovations end up as fleeting fads. An alluring part of the traditional watch industry is the idea of longevity and being able to pass a timepiece down the generations. As the afternoon goes on, Michael tells me they receive watches for battery placements with engravings on. Their customers are clearly choosing this young brand to begin a new story, and I'm intrigued as to how they find a balance between looking to the future and cherishing the craft of the traditional industry.
Smart watches, smart technology, and technology in general, they're tools. So there's innovation with those in the sense of digital platforms, and that's obviously relevant, very relevant. Yeah, we all need that now, whether we like it or not, we're in that world, and that's going to keep developing. It will change, and it will change in another way. But if you get a smart watch or whatever, you don't cherish it. It's a tool, and if it breaks, you're just annoyed, so you're going to go and sort it out. And 2 years down the line, you're annoyed because the software is old, or the hardware is old. We've never ventured into doing smart watches because that's not our game. But we do something else, which we think is of a totally different, it's a totally different field. And that's creating things that people can have some kind of connection with where they cherish it, look after it. But we need to be of the moment too. So what's going on in the world now? Well, this technology is a good example. This is what's happening. We're trying to look forward. I think that's the only way you can really be something that when people look back, if people buy one of our watches now with one of these straps on, then in 30 or 40 years, I think that's the best work we can do to mean that when they look back on, they look at that watch in years to come, they'll look back at it with some care and it will mean something to them still.
These days, buying a watch is a lifestyle choice. It makes a statement about the wearer. Purchasing a 5-figure timepiece also buys a certain amount of prestige, even if the parts were manufactured by the same people in the same Swiss factory. But Uniform Wears displays no logos on its watch faces. The strap developed by Beathtype is inconspicuous, despite its uniqueness, and their advertising is minimalistic.
We don't create this lifestyle. We're not a brand that talks about a lifestyle and sells that to people. We just try and design and make the nicest product we can. The watch industry is full of smoke and mirrors and this lifestyle and glossy images of some of a celebrity or someone standing in front. I mean, I'm not going to, everyone's seen the picture of a guy standing in front of a Spitfire. I'm sorry, but I don't relate to that because I don't own a Spitfire.
What? Really?
Yeah. Our story is just a totally different one. So people come into us for that story. They come into us because our story, they relate more closely to it. And then on the other side, we've got guys who've been in the watch world for years. Got 3 Rolexes, 2 Cartiers and a Patek Philippe, but they still relate to us in a way because they can see that we take a lot of care and attention to the product.
And that's really the beauty of Uniform Wears. Some heritage brands can fall into the trap of trying to sell a product to customers, whereas Michael, Matt and Sarat just want to make good design. This philosophy is exactly what tradition is about.
A very special thanks to Christy Evans for that report. Now, the UK's menswear industry has tended to be split between Savile Row tailoring and boundary-pushing designers such as J.W. Anderson. Few brands occupy the coveted in-between space, making pieces that are tailored but contemporary. Casey Hayford, a London label by father and son team Joe and Charlie, is one such brand, however. Last month, they opened their first shop, a charming 2-storey affair, in Marylebone, no less, very close to our Midori House HQ. The space is designed by Charlie's wife, Sophie Ashby. It's a fitting venue for the decade-old brand, and Monocle's Jamie Waters joined Charlie for a tour of the new space.
We design for people who know themselves well enough that they don't need to wear clothing that shouts that they're wearing a brand. We try and make beautiful clothes that are timeless and people consider investment pieces, but still have a modern edge and innovative thinking. We've always kind of preferred the softer touch rather than making abrasive statements.
We're sitting in your beautiful new shop in Marylebone. You've had a warehouse in Tottenham. Why did you decide to open this shop now? And yeah, what's the kind of thinking behind that move?
Well, I think most importantly, we wanted to open the store to mark the 10-year anniversary of the brand. We've watched the fashion world, I think, as has everyone, changed so significantly over the last few years. One of the big influences actually being social media and how it's affected how people consume fashion. I think one of the big concerns for us is that we really love what we do. It's a shame to see the way that people consume fashion now. Because of fast fashion, I think there's less value given to clothing. And for us, that's such an important thing. The idea of creating garments that last the test of time, that are an investment, but still have a modern outlook. And the store was really a way for us to realize that, and also for people to share a small piece of our world and kind of what we stand for.
In terms of the store, I mean, it's a very sort of distinctive, homely place. It was designed by your wife. Tell us a bit about the kind of that sort of process.
Yeah, so the store's designed by my wife, who runs up an interior design company called Studio Ashby. And from day one, the brief really was to create a space that felt like an apartment. And I think more than that, we wanted it to feel like our apartment, and that it was reflective of the family values that we share. Because I think the definition of fashion is essentially based on transiency and always creating the new. And I think I love, as do my parents, love the idea that there's an integrity in creating a world that's based around family. And it's something that a lot of people can relate to. So for us, it was really important the store reflected that. So the store from top to bottom is reminiscent of our world in terms of pieces borrowed from my and my wife's apartment, from my parents' house. Things that we had in our house growing up are in here. So it just feels very intimate. And we hope that breaks down any kind of barriers that people, I think, often experience when entering into a luxury store.
So Charlie, we're now going to do a walkthrough of the store. So we're standing at the entrance. It's a double story space. We're upstairs at the entrance. So this is the ready-to-wear section, ready-to-wear floor. Do you want to just kind of walk us through some of your favorite pieces and some of the kind of design elements in the space as well?
Sure. So with regards to the space itself, it is an intimate floor. And I think we really wanted to play on that and also bring some love to the ground through a lot of artwork that are predominantly actually young British artists. For instance, we have a large work of art by Tom O'Campbell just around the stairwell, and we wanted to reflect those colours in this hand-threaded staircase that we have been working on for months.
Yeah, so this is amazing. I mean, this is one of the first things that your eyes are drawn to. It's like this woven, these woven, I guess, sort of panels around the metal staircase, like in sort of pale pinks and blues. What I believe this has been a labor of love, this woven.
An ongoing labor of love. It was my wife's idea several months ago. And the man hours, I mean, I've lost count, have gone into it, and it's still ongoing. But I think it's a wonderful reflection of the kind of craftsmanship that goes into our work. The threads and cloth that are used are actually from old runway collections. And we've tried to kind of maintain that concept throughout the store, where we're using recycled garments and recycled elements. So our till point is actually made from recycled plastic bottles.
Our very special thanks to Monocle's fashion editor Jamie Waters for that report. Sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Do tune in again next week. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show or our sister podcast On Design Extra, which is available every Thursday. For more design-minded information, you can also pick up a copy of Monocle magazine, our libraries of books, or our many seasonal newspapers that keep us oh so busy throughout the year. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Ta-ta.